And Radio Lux Licit is on the air. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Today is Friday, July 22nd, 2016, and this is episode 2. Well, there's a lot been going on this past week, and I suppose for Americans most prominently, we're thinking about political conventions. The Republicans just had their convention this past week, as most of you probably know. The Republicans, to no one's surprise, nominated Donald Trump as the presidential candidate for 2016. And next week, the Democrats will have their opportunity to have a convention, at which time they will nominate Hillary Clinton. And I believe I saw something here this evening where she has even chosen a running mate. So it's an individual by the name of Tim Kaine, a Virginia senator. So we'll get to see that next week. Well, at any rate, since we're right in the middle of convention season, it seemed not unreasonable to talk a little bit about politics. This has been really an extraordinary election season in the United States. We have seen the rise of two unlikely protest candidates, Donald Trump, and on the Democratic side, we saw Bernie Sanders make a pretty impressive run as well. And a lot of people have wondered, you know, why is this? Why has there been this rise of the protest vote? I saw something today on CNBC, and this was a quote from a former official in the Reagan and the George H.W. Bush administrations. Her name was Mary Jo Jacoby, and I think she put this pretty succinctly, so I'll read you what she had to say. This was her quote in the CNBC article. She said of Trump that in talking about his speech that he gave, his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention on Thursday night, said of Trump that he, quote, he promised them a voice, and I think that was extremely powerful because people in America feel unheard and uncared for, disregarded by the power elites, end quote. That's a pretty good quote. I think there are a lot of Americans who have felt more and more that this country is not really so much the republic that it was founded to be, but has really, especially in the last few years, become very much more of an oligarchy, where we have a power elite class, a rulership class that lords it over everyone and basically tells the peasants pretty much how it's going to be. And there are some good reasons for why people might think that. There are a couple of really glaring examples just in the last few years. Actually, one of them from just a few weeks ago. On the economic side, you know, go back to 2008 and think about the Wall Street bailouts. There was a big financial crisis in the fall of 2008. Stock market plunged. A lot of major Wall Street firms were threatening to go bankrupt. And Congress, the House of Representatives, had to vote on whether or not to pass what was called the TARP legislation. That was the bailout legislation, the big $700 billion bailout package for Wall Street. They voted it down the first time, and then I think that someone must have gotten to them and knocked a little quote sense into them, got their thinking straight, as it were. And they took a second vote, and the second vote they voted the quote right way and passed the legislation. And this was over against enormous opposition to it from the American people. It was basically the Wall Street Washington axis of power, and they did what they wanted to do despite the wishes, despite the strong wishes of the American people. That was an example of oligarchy. Of course, here just recently, just this year, we see not only do we have a two-tiered financial system where the rich are bailed out, but the ordinary folks, the Main Street people, if you will, you know, they lose their jobs, they lose their homes, and once they do get work again, if they get work again, they're generally making a lot less money. You know, average household income is down for the vast majority of people in this country, while it's rocketed to the moon for the very top 1% or maybe 0.1% of the nation. So we've got this growing income inequality, this growing economic inequality, a sort of a two-tiered economic system. I've even read here recently where the middle class, at least as this one article that I saw defined the middle class, and I don't recall exactly what their definition was, but the middle class is now less than 50% of the United States. And when I was growing up, going back and say, I think in 1970, they said that over 60% of the United States fell into what was called the middle class. So, I mean, there is real pressure on ordinary middle class Americans. People are dropping out of the middle class. People are becoming poorer. The vast majority of Americans are worse off now than they were, say, 10 years ago, financially. But in addition to a two-tiered financial system that we have developed here, we've also developed a very obvious two-tiered justice system. We saw a very dramatic example of that just last week when Hillary Clinton, despite mountains of evidence that she had committed probably multiple felonies, was let off the hook. The FBI director elected not to recommend charges, and of course the Department of Justice obliged and did not pursue charges against Hillary Clinton. I would say from my standpoint, she's probably the single most indictable person I've ever seen. And yet she got away with crimes that no one else could get away with. And the interesting thing is the FBI director, James Comey, even said pretty much that when he was having his press conference. He says, well, just because Hillary Clinton got away with it, don't think that other people can get away with this. Essentially, he endorsed the fact that we have a two-tiered justice system. Maybe if your last name's Clinton, you can get away with murder, but, God forbid if you're an ordinary American, you can have the book thrown at you for all sorts of very minor offenses. People resent that, and there are some very good reasons for resenting that. That is not the way that governments are supposed to be, and yet our government has become very much a top-down oligarchy. That's not what the Bible says about how governments are to operate, I should say. The case of Donald Trump is particularly interesting for a number of reasons, and I'll speak to that since he was just made the Republican nominee. Not only did he become the nominee, but he actually set the record for the most number of votes received in the Republican primaries. And you would think that after 8 years of being out of power in the White House, the Republican Party would be excited about having a candidate that is able to attract so many voters. I mean, there's genuine voter enthusiasm for Donald Trump in a way that I haven't seen before, except maybe going back to Ronald Reagan. I'm old enough to remember when Ronald Reagan first ran. This goes back to 1980. And people were passionate supporters of Ronald Reagan, and they still are today. The name of Ronald Reagan is very much revered, at least among Republicans, as being someone that they would like to emulate. And you might think that Trump would have garnered some real enthusiasm also from the Republican elders, but such is not the case. In fact, not only do the prominent Republicans dislike Trump, they're actually his harshest critics. And along with them, along with the official party brass, if you will, other prominent movement conservatives, people that belong to sometimes what are called mainstream conservative movement, or sometimes what's referred to as conservative ink, mainstream conservatives bitterly opposed Donald Trump. For instance, the National Review ran a full issue, I think it was back in February. All the articles in it, apparently, I don't have the issue, but I read about this, but that all the articles were devoted to essentially bashing Donald Trump and saying why he should not be the nominee. And of course, that was back before the Republican nomination was still open to question. We didn't know for sure that Trump would win, even though he was the front runner at the time. Another prominent conservative publication, Weekly Standard, has routinely denounced Donald Trump. Head of that news magazine, William Kristol, Bill Kristol, has worked the last several months to try to find someone who would usurp Donald Trump as the Republican nominee. That obviously did not work, but it wasn't for lack of trying on the part of Bill Kristol. Prominent conservative columnist George Will basically took his toys and went home. Yeah, he went back to his safe space someplace, and he stomped off the stage in a huff. So angry was he that Trump was the nominee that he actually quit the Republican Party. There are other prominent Republicans have made noises about voting for Hillary Clinton if Donald Trump is the nominee. So we'll see if they make good on their promise there. But there's just been tremendous opposition to Donald Trump. And I think really the conservative, the mainstream conservative movement has been a harsher critic of Donald Trump than even what the mainstream Democrats have been, oddly enough. I think there's a reason for that, but we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But it's at least on the surface a rather surprising development. The other thing that's interesting too about the whole Donald Trump phenomenon, of course, is that ordinary Americans, at least ordinary Republican voters, really couldn't care less what the mainstream Republicans have to say. Ordinary Republican voters are thoroughly disgusted at the Washington Wall Street oligarchy, and they have very good reason to be disgusted with them. Detailed some of that with the situations with Wall Street bailouts, the perception that we have a two-tiered justice system. Another example that you can even add to that is you might even call it the corporate oligarchy. I read a few months ago, I think it was at the end of the first quarter, where the board of British Petroleum voted to give the CEO of that company a 20% raise. Now, I think the man was making something like $13 million already, and so they gave him a 20% raise, so they jumped up his pay, I don't know, what, $2.6 million, something like that. And this was done at a time when the stock price has been plummeting, and the company's laying off workers. Now, of course, part of the reason the stock price has gone down is because the price of oil went down tremendously in 2015 and in early 2016. Now, that's not something that the CEO is responsible for, but when your stock price is plummeting, when you're laying off 4,000 workers, and BP, British Petroleum, did announce that they were going to lay off 4,000 workers, when you have a company that's going through difficult times, it's more than just a little bit unseemly for a board of directors to offer and for a CEO to accept a 20% pay raise. One of the things that the Bible talks about leadership, and it talks about those who are in positions of authority, and that they are to be servants. They're not to lord it over people, they're to be servants. And one of the ways that those in office serve is by leading by example. When a CEO accepts a huge pay raise on top of an already huge salary at a time when the company is struggling, what kind of a signal does that send to the other people in the organization? It's a two-tiered organization. You have an aristocracy, a corporate aristocracy, and you have a corporate peasantry. And this is becoming the case pretty much everywhere, as I said, in politics, in the legal realm, in the area of business. You see this more and more. You have an aristocracy and you have a peasantry. Of course, in the United States, we have a constitutional prohibition against titles of nobility, but we almost have a de facto nobility now. And it's quite a remarkable thing. So people are disgusted by this. Ordinary Americans, as I said, Republican voters, and not just Republicans, Democrat voters as well are disgusted by it. And that's one of the reasons why Bernie Sanders did so well. And so ordinary Americans have seen the types of things that have been said by conservative leaders, by the stalwarts of the conservative movement, and they haven't been terribly impressed by it. You know, if I might maybe want to draw an analogy here in baseball, you know, if a baseball team consistently loses year in and year out, there's a good chance that the manager's probably going to get fired, replaced, and somebody else is going to be brought in. Well, if you take a look at what mainstream conservatives have done, you know, they have this sense of entitlement, this sense that that somehow they deserve to be where they are, regardless of what results they turn in. And frankly, if you look at the history of what conservatives have done over the last, say, 60 years or so, since the founding of the modern conservative movement, their track record is frankly pretty miserable. I mean, what have these guys ever conserved? I'm talking about conservative movement, conservative people. You know, Ronald Reagan famously asked the question in 1980, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And Americans are coming more and more to ask themselves the questions, are we better off today than we were 60 years ago when the conservative movement started? And many of them are answering the question in the negative. No, we're not better off. I mean, think about all the things that have occurred since 1955. The national debt has exploded since 1955. We've gone through the sexual revolution, we've gone through the hippie culture in the 60s, we've gone has seen the rise of feminism, we've seen the rise of the homosexual movement. Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971, what was left of the gold standard, which has helped destroy the nation's finances. We've seen an explosion in the size of government over the last several decades. Johnson's Great Society programs, Nixon created the EPA, we had the Department of Energy created in the 1970s, we saw massive inflation in the 1970s. When Reagan came into office, you had the Reagan Revolution, but a lot of that was fueled by deficit spending. The deficits boomed during Ronald Reagan's presidency. And that's where the saying came, deficits don't matter. And the U.S. government deficit and the U.S. government debt has ballooned ever since Reagan was in office. It's grown to some truly frightening proportions. During the 1990s, we had all the scandals with the Clintons. Here in the 2000s, the first decade and a half of the 2000s, we've seen a tremendous expansion of government power. George Bush created the prescription drug laws that expanded government and health care. We saw the crackdown on civil liberties after 9/11, the Patriot Act, and some of the other legislation has been passed. We've seen healthcare be nationalized under Obama. We've seen gay marriage be approved by the Supreme Court in all 50 states. These are the things that have happened over the last 60 years. In the field of finance, they have a saying, the trend is your friend. Well, if you're a conservative, the trend is definitely not your friend. Over the last 60 years, the trend has been horrible. Going back to that question, what have the conservatives ever conserved? I don't know. I don't think they've conserved much of anything. And people are coming to realize that. And some of these conservatives, when they get out and they criticize Donald Trump and they say he's not a true conservative, well, a lot of people would say, well, so what? Maybe that's a good thing. Now, the question really that people should be asking at this point, or maybe an important question, would be this. Regardless of whether Trump is a true conservative or not, the question is, would a Donald Trump presidency fix what ails the nation? Now, to answer that question, I would appeal to some things that John Robbins talked about. Of course, John Robbins, as you may be aware, he had a doctorate in political philosophy, so he was very much interested in politics. He was actively involved in politics. through much of his life as well. So he knows politics both from a theoretical, philosophical standpoint, as well as from being engaged in it. And a point that he made on numerous occasions in various lectures or articles that, or even books that he had written, is that the political liberty, the prosperity that Americans have historically enjoyed, it's the result of the widespread preaching of and belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ by the American people. Now, as the nation has become less Christian, and I think very few people would argue that that's not the case, that Christianity is much less of an influence on what goes on day to day in our country than what it used to be. Even 30 years ago, let alone if you go back 100 years or 150 or 200 years, that as America's become less and less Christian, that we've become less and less free. And that it's really the things that Americans believe, the theology, if you will, of the American people, that has caused the decline in our freedom, has caused the decline in our prosperity. That's what really lies at the root of the problem. And there was an extraordinary quote, and I'm going to read this to you here in just a moment, of John Robbins talking about this very issue. There was a lecture that he gave, and this is on the Trinity Foundation website, and I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes here today. But I'm going to read you this quote, and this is actually at the very end of the lecture. It's at about the 32-minute mark, and John Robbins is responding to a question that was asked by someone in the audience. And I thought what he had to say was really pretty extraordinary. I'm going to just read you what he said here. This is a somewhat longish quote, so bear with me for just a moment here. Again, this is at the 32-minute mark of the lecture, Religious Wars of the 21st Century. This is what Robin said. He said, quote, "Over the past 50 years, conservatives and libertarians have spent tens of billions of dollars lobbying, trying to elect candidates, trying to organize in various ways. Now, when I was a kid, I was out passing out literature for Barry Goldwater back in 1964. Maybe some of you did as well if you remember back that far. And what has it gained? Are we better off, to use a campaign slogan, are we better off today than we were 50 years ago or in 1964? What have all the conservatives and libertarians done with those tens of billions of dollars that have shown any improvement in the political, the moral climate of the country? Now, if that money had been put into preaching of the gospel, the uncompromised, unvarnished, pure gospel, perhaps there would be something completely different to show for it. But it was put into compromised political action, and there's nothing to show for it. Absolutely nothing. Tens of billions of dollars. When you think of all the campaigns, all the organizations, and I've been involved in, my degree is in political theory, political philosophy. I've been interested in politics all my life, and I've been involved from time to time working on Capitol Hill. And I learned a very good lesson on Capitol Hill, that what happens there is of very little consequence. That if one is interested in changing society, you don't go to Capitol Hill. You preach the gospel. Now, you can preach it on Capitol Hill. I'm not saying you shouldn't preach it on Capitol Hill. They need to hear it too. But if anybody is operating under the illusion that political action is going to make a significant change in society, apart from a sea change in the beliefs of the American people, then they're condemned to futility. They will waste their lives." End quote. And there, Robbins really gets to the heart of the matter. The problems that we have today fundamentally are not political. They're not matters of ultimately of the legal system. They are not matters of economics, ultimately. Those things, the problems that we have in those areas, in the areas of politics, of law, of economics, the problems that we're experiencing with business, with people being laid off, lack of income growth, with people having difficulty even just making ends meet. Ordinary Americans. Most Americans have hardly any savings at all. Now, this has been shown many, many times. Ultimately, all those things, though, that we see and that we talk about and that are really kind of hot-button issues in today's politics, they're not really fundamentally the issue. The real problem, the heart of the matter, the root of the problem is spiritual. There's a real lack of preaching. There's a real lack of belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And until that changes, there's no good reason to expect there to be any substantial change in the direction of the republic. So to go back to the question that I asked, you know, will a Donald Trump presidency fix what ails the nation? Well, apart from the preaching of the gospel, I would say no. I don't expect there to be very much change at all. We've got some very difficult problems that we're going to have to tackle as a nation if we're ever going to get back on track. But if we're actually going to be able to tackle those problems, it's not going to come because of who's president. It's going to come because the American people, once again, turn to the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel of justification by faith alone. You know, not a pseudo-gospel, you know, not the gospel of Rome, not the gospel that's preached in most churches, but the gospel of Jesus Christ that tells us that we are justified, that we are washed, that we are cleansed, that we are made fit to stand before God by faith in Jesus Christ alone. And once we come to understand that, once we come to understand the gospel, we also come to understand the implications of the gospel, and the gospel has political implications. The clear teaching of Scripture is that government should be limited, that government should be constitutional. The clear teaching of Scripture is that private property is absolutely essential to any civilized society. I think John Robbins called it the principal institution in any civilized society, that is private property. And if we're ever going to get back to the understanding the importance of freedom, of individual freedom, of private property, of private contract, it's going to start with the gospel of Jesus Christ. One of my favorite essays that John Robbins wrote is a piece that he first published in 1978 and then later republished in 2002. It's called Conservatism and Autopsy. I'm going to put the link to that that essay in the show notes as well. I think it's a really extraordinary essay. And Robbins closes the essay. He has a quote from Scripture, and maybe that's a good place to stop this this podcast as well. Here's the quote that Robbins provided. He said, quote, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Thank you for listening in today. Again, this is Radio Luke Solicit. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Until next week, I'd encourage you to remember that all things, I don't mean some things, but I mean that all things, and no matter how bad things get, this is true, that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose.